Today is Tuesday, April 13th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Myanmar's ousted leader was back in virtual court Monday and charged with another crime.
This is the new charge they had that she was gathering with her supporters last year during this COVID time.
Plus, Ukraine continues trying to meet with Russia about the buildup of troops along its border. And as Ramadan begins, Muslims around the world navigate the sacred month for a second time during the pandemic. We'll have these stories and more next. Myanmar's ruling military squared off against its opponents in the courts, the streets, and the countryside Monday, showing no signs of relenting in its crackdown against those opposed to February's coup. Earlier, I spoke with reporter Cape Diamond in Yangon about the ongoing unrest and the new charge leveled against ousted leader Aung San Suu Kyi.
This is the new charge they had that she was gathering with her supporters last year during this COVID time. And they say, you know, it make the people gather, it was against the COVID-19 law. That's what they said. At the same time, the lawyers were trying to meet with her.
Right. And Aung San Suu Kyi again made the request to meet in person with her legal team. Has there been any response from the government about granting that request?
I spoke to the lawyers the other day, and it was like they've been trying to request, you know, trying to send the different requests, including, you know, the attorney power for the representing lawyers. But some of the requests did not success. And of course, this time they requested again. So, you know, wait and see how the government and the military will respond. But so far, there's been no response from them.
I want to switch gears for just a second and head towards Bago City. On Friday, authorities opened up on protesters there and killed, by some reports, over 80. How has the community responded to that act of violence?
Well, the communities in Bago, and of course, not only in Bago, but also in the different places of Myanmar, people are, they're not scared, but they are acting very carefully because the military has been using the live round. And since last month, there have been no warning from the security forces when they cracked down the protest. So this was also a bloody crackdown from the security forces on the protesters. At the same time, on the military-controlled state TV, they've been claiming that the protesters being armed. That's why they are, you know, they have to crack down the protesters. But at the same time, as far as we know, that the protesters are not arming. They only have slingshot, and they use a slingshot to like defend themselves against the armed militaries and the police. Of course, you know, I've been speaking to different people from Bago, and I was told that they can't really get back their dead bodies, like the dead body of their friends, their family members, because, you know, they've been those dead body being taken by the security forces. At the same time, the Bago University Student Union claimed that, you know, that people have to like pay the money to the military to get back the dead bodies.
And that is what the student organization is saying. By some reports, it's as much as $85 for family members to reclaim the bodies of people who died last Friday in Bago City. Have you been able to, you know, confirm it with any other organizations?
Well, I spoke to the different people. As I said, they said that some of the people say, you know, they heard that it was true because some of their friends, you know, they had to pay for it. And of course, as I was checking with this Bago student union, like Facebook and some of the member, you know, on the social media, and they claim that.
And the last thing I want to talk about is you mentioned to it a little bit earlier that the people are still not intimidated by the use of force by the military junta to crack down on protests. in general throughout the country, what is the mood since we are seeing an uptick in the violence used against those who are peacefully protesting?
Well, the peaceful protesters, they are not stopping at any point. They keep, you know, demonstrating. They keep protesting against the junta. Sometimes we say, oh, you know, people are not really in the street, you know, holding the banners and signs against the junta. But at the same time, they are protesting even from their home. Like on the social media, we have seen, you know, people using like different theme, you know, different style of the protest. Like today, they say, okay, today is for the like green strike. You know, they've been using the tree, like they've been writing and drawing some pictures, you know, portraying that they're against the junta on the leaf of the tree. You know, like the other day, you know, on the day of the Easter, you know, they draw the pictures on the Easter egg. You know, they've been using the creative way to describe that they are not just staying. They are like, they are trying to, you know, run the movement against the junta in a different way. But at the same time, we have been seeing that, you know, the places like Mandalay, Monjua, Damu, which is the border city with India, like they're going out on the street every day, you know, against the junta. So the movement never been stopped.
Cape Diamond reports from Myanmar. United Nations spokesperson Stéphane Dujarric says that the Secretary General expresses deep concern over the recent reports of violence in the country. He also says that the UN Rights Office in Myanmar indicates that 93 protesters were killed in Bago City Friday and...
As of today, credible reports show at least 707 people having been killed since the military seized control of the government more than 2 months ago. It is believed this may be significantly higher.
Since February 1st, thousands of people have been injured, many of them seriously. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky has not yet been able to speak to his Russian counterpart, Vladimir Putin, to discuss the escalating conflict in eastern Ukraine, despite lodging a request to do so. Reuters' Emily Wither takes it from here.
Kiev and Moscow have traded blame over the worsening situation in the eastern Donbas region. President Volodymyr Zelensky's office says Russia has rebuffed attempts by Kiev to start talks over its increased military presence, while a Kremlin spokesman says they have seen no such request for talks in recent days. Video shows dozens of troop carriers and missile launchers lining up along tracks running through southern Russia in a region bordering Ukraine. Moscow denies it is part of the conflict in eastern Ukraine, saying it provides only humanitarian and political support to the separatists. Zelensky's spokeswoman says Russia has amassed 40,000 troops on their eastern border and more than 40,000 troops in Crimea. After talks with Turkey at the weekend, Zelensky is headed for Paris, where he'll meet French President Emmanuel Macron. Ukraine fears the Kremlin is engineering a crisis to rally Russians around a foreign enemy ahead of parliamentary elections in September, in an attempt to shift the narrative away from domestic issues, such as jailed opposition figure Alexei Navalny. The Kremlin says Russia is free to move forces around its own territory as it sees fit for defensive purposes. The standoff has sparked concerns from Ukraine's Western backers. Washington and the NATO alliance have accused Russia of a provocative build-up.
Emily Wither from Reuters. U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin was in Israel Monday meeting with Israeli officials about Iran. The meeting comes as a power failure at an Iranian nuclear site of Natanz reportedly caused massive damage to Iranian centrifuges. Iranian officials blame Israel and are threatening to avenge the attack. Linda Gradstein has more.
Israel rarely takes responsibility for attacks like the one in Natanz that Israeli news reports on Monday said could set the Iranian nuclear program back by 9 months. But the Israeli Army Chief of Staff, Aviv Kochavi, hinted Israel may have been involved. He said the Israeli army's activities in the Middle East are not hidden from the eyes of the enemy, that they are watching us, they see our capabilities. Secretary Austin, the first official from U.S. President Joe Biden's administration to visit Israel, did not mention Iran directly, saying only that he and Israeli Defense Minister Benny Gantz discussed regional security challenges. Austin's visit came as the U.S. looks to restart talks with Iran about reviving the Iran nuclear deal, the JCPOA, after former President Trump pulled out of the agreement in 2015. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has come out strongly against the deal, saying it gives Iran a legal way to acquire a nuclear weapon. Iran analyst Eldad Shavit says the growing tensions between Israel and Iran might push the Biden administration closer to a new deal with Iran.
There's a reason to assess or to believe that the administration will be even now more under pressure to reach an agreement with the Iranians, because it's their strategic objective to return to JCPOA, because they don't have an alternative policy vis-a-vis Iran.
In the past few weeks, there have been reports of several Israeli attacks on Iranian targets, including on a Revolutionary Guard base on a ship. Seema Shine of the Institute for National Security Studies says Iran will try to retaliate for these, and especially for the Natanz attack.
If I have to put the list, what are the possibilities of Iran to retaliate, I would say that they would prefer to do it in several places and several fields if they are if the capability. They tried in the past, and I'm sure they will try again in the cyber field if they have any capability, a dramatic one, to penetrate into Israeli civilian infrastructure. They tried, as you know, in the water field and others. They will try to do it in the future if it will be possible for them and successful.
Iran's foreign minister said the Natanz site will be rebuilt with more advanced centrifuges that can enrich uranium even faster. Linda Gradstein for VOA News, Jerusalem.
The European Union has imposed sanctions on 8 Iranians, including militia commanders, police chiefs, and Hossein Salami, the head of Iran's Revolutionary Guards. The sanctions, which take effect immediately for their roles in a November 2019 crackdown on protests in Iran. The sanctions freeze any assets the 8 individuals have in the EU and ban them from traveling in EU territory. Reuters reports these are the first sanctions the EU has imposed on Iranians since 2013. You're listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Steve Miller. The International Monetary Fund says that Lebanon won't pull itself out of its economic crisis until a new government is formed to start long-stalled reforms. But Lebanese analysts say they are being held hostage by a corrupt political class and need outside help to break the logjam to create conditions that bring the country back from the brink. One suggestion is to set up a temporary United Nations trusteeship council for Lebanon to get the country back on its feet. Dale Gavlak has that story.
By defaulting on its $1.2 billion Eurobond debt last year, Lebanon's currency crashed and its economy shrank by 25%. Jihad Azur, head of the International Monetary Fund's Middle East Department, told Reuters that addressing Lebanon's dire economic crisis now requires a comprehensive approach with multiple financial and governance reforms. He warned that in the absence of a new government that can lead this transformation, it's very difficult to expect that the situation will in itself improve. But Professor Habib Malik of the Lebanese American University told VOA that the Lebanese people are caught in a vice between the political warlords and the de facto power, the Iran-backed Hezbollah militia.
The rest of the world has pretty much taken the position, form a government and start implementing reform, and then we will come and help. That's like telling the fox, we're going to put you in charge of the chicken coop, and then once you take care of the chickens, we'll come in and help. These people will not implement any reforms that will in any way diminish their theft, power, and control. Second is, you Lebanese have to deal with Hezbollah on your own. That's like telling the hostage with a gun to his head, you have to free yourself from your captor, and then we'll come and help you. That never happens in a hostage situation either.
Economist Tawfiq Gaspard, a former senior advisor to the Lebanese finance minister and to the IMF, says he doesn't see the resumption of economic growth for Lebanon without financial and fiscal cleanup.
Therein lies the problem, because the political system is one of sharing of spoils, not increasing the spoils. When there will be fiscal or financial reform, whatever it is, they're going to come against the problem of this political system where the authorities are more interested in sharing the spoils than anything else.
Lebanon cannot be saved as a state unless influential external actors collectively and individually decide to step in and create conditions that could pull Lebanon back from the abyss, says Emil Nekle, a retired CIA senior intelligence officer who now directs the Global and National Security Policy Institute at the University of New Mexico. He suggests setting up a temporary UN trusteeship council for Lebanon. Writing in an online publication, The Cipher Brief, Nekle says this would not aim at regime change, but at creating a functioning state system that rebuilds the national institutions and the economy. It would reestablish trust in the government and hold senior officials accountable for their actions. A professional and independent judiciary is critical for public accountability and trust. Nekle warns that if these conditions are allowed to continue, Lebanon could become bankrupt within 2 years, paving the way for malign forces to exploit Lebanon's instability. Dale Gatlach for VOA News, Amman.
Ecuadorian banker Guillermo Lasso has won Sunday's presidential runoff vote against leftist economist Andreas Arauz, putting the country on track to maintain open market policies rather than a return to socialism. Reuters' Brian Wood.
Lasso ran on a platform promising to jumpstart the economy with free market economics against social welfare plans from Arauz.
This is a historic day. It is a day in which all Ecuadorians have decided their future. They have expressed with their vote the need for change and the desire for better days for all.
The results set the country apart in South America in its rejection of socialism, while Argentina, Chile, and Bolivia have seen recent popular leftist movements. Ecuador instead is set to maintain its open market policies, a move welcomed by foreign investors wary of the country's weak finances. The global health crisis has pushed a third of Ecuador's population into poverty and left 500,000 people unemployed. Outgoing President Lenin Moreno, who did not seek re-election, was unable to revive the economy. Lasso is set to take office at the end of May.
Brian Wood reports for Reuters News. As a global computer chip shortage continues hurting a variety of industries, U.S. President Joe Biden is pushing for the United States to become the world's chip leader. AP Washington correspondent Sagar Magani reports.
The shortage has delayed a new iPhone, made it harder for schools to buy laptops for home learning, and shuttered auto factories because there aren't enough chips to finish building vehicles that are essentially rolling computers. At a virtual meeting with CEOs from Dell, Intel, Ford, and other companies, the president said his massive infrastructure plan will help the U.S. build its own chip supply chain, saying American investments now lag behind competitors like China.
Put it bluntly, we have to step up our game.
And build today's infrastructure, not repair yesterday's. Sagar Magani, Washington.
George Floyd's brother has testified in the Minneapolis, Minnesota trial of the former white police officer that is accused of killing the African man. The AP's Ed Donahue has this update.
He's the younger brother in the family.
Philonis O'Neill Floyd.
He testified he looked up to his big brother, and George Floyd looked out for him.
He used to make the best banana mayonnaise sandwiches, and he used to make syrup sandwiches because George couldn't cook.
The prosecution showed Philonis Floyd a picture of his mother with a young boy.
That's my oldest brother, George. I miss both of them.
Also, Dr. Jonathan Rich, a cardiology expert, echoed earlier witnesses testifying it wasn't a drug overdose or a heart condition that killed George Floyd.
It was truly the prone restraint and positional restraints that led to his asphyxiation.
Tape from Court TV. I'm Ed Donahue.
Authorities say multiple people, including a police officer, have been shot at a high school in the East Tennessee city of Knoxville. The scene has since been secured. The Knoxville Police Department tweeted that authorities were on the scene of the shooting Monday at the Austin East Magnet High School. The online posting says a Knoxville Police Department officer is reported among the victims. Police are urging people to avoid the area. Details remain unclear, and news outlets show numerous police and emergency vehicles outside the school.
This is Science in a Minute.
Researchers in the U.S. states of California and Georgia have found evidence that drinking sugar-sweetened beverages early in life may lead to impaired brain function in adulthood. The researchers, who outlined their findings in a study published by Translational Psychiatry, also suggest sugar-filled beverages may cause changes in a person's gut microbiome, the community of microorganisms that live inside our digestive systems. The scientists experimenting with rats found those who consume the sweet drinks had two specific gut bacteria species than others who only drank water. They found that the rats with the additional bacterial species displayed a memory impairment in the brain's hippocampus when they became adults. The study adds to growing proof that sugary drinks may not be good for you. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. Anti-Asian hate crime is on the rise in many parts of the world, including Vancouver, Canada, according to a new report by the Vancouver Police Department. Home to a large population of ethnic Asians, the Western Canadian city has seen a sharp rise in racist attacks coinciding with the COVID-19 pandemic. Craig McCulloch has that story.
A recently released report from the Vancouver Police Department shows a 717% increase in hate crimes in the city targeting the Asian community, rising from 12 in 2019 to 98 last year. The numbers mirror disturbing trends in the United States and are startling in a diverse city with a large and well-established Asian community. Government statistics show that 42% of the population of metropolitan Vancouver are of Asian descent. Many families have been in Canada for generations, with their ancestors coming around the 1858 gold rush and to work on building the country's first national railway the following decade. Now, well into 2021, those hate crimes are continuing to get headlines. On March 30th, a 47-year-old was charged with the rarely used public incitement of hatred and mischief to property after writing racist graffiti on windows of the Greater Vancouver Chinese Cultural Center. Fred Kwok, chairperson of the center, says the racist vandalism was planned and intentional.
I would say malicious intent to spread xenophobia to general public. And on top of that, actually, I mentioned that to the police. I said, this is almost like, I can compare that to an act of terrorism that's sole purpose is to put fear in all Chinese.
Queenie Chu is the CEO of Success, a Vancouver-based nonprofit organization that helps new immigrants, predominantly from Asia, in Canada. Chu says there's always been some racism against the Asian community, but politicians in the Western Hemisphere renaming COVID-19 into a Chinese-sounding flu did not help. She's urging more research and documentation on the issue.
One of the ways to do it is to collect of race-based data in consultation with communities, and be open about why and what data is collected and how it will be used to make improvements so that we understand the magnitude of the situation.
Chu also says Canadians must confront systemic racism in Canada, adding that government should fund anti-racism campaigns, including educational initiatives. Constable Tanya Vizantine, spokesperson for the Vancouver Police Department, says the increase in race-based attacks in the city is surprising.
It was quite baffling, especially because we're such a multicultural city. So the fact that there was so much hate towards those of East Asian descent in particular was quite upsetting.
Vizantine says the department has made it easier to report hate crimes online. It is hoped more data and documentation will help the city reverse the trend. Craig McCulloch for VOA News, Vancouver.
The Mekong is one of the world's great rivers, a 5,000-kilometer waterway threading from China through Laos, Thailand, Cambodia, and Vietnam. However, dams have subverted the ecosystem, bringing drought during the monsoon season and high waters when it should be dry. That has forever changed the lives of those who depend on the river for food and work in northeastern Thailand, a poor region bordering Laos and Cambodia. Wichitara Dongdi brings us this story.
Panning for flecks of gold on the banks of the Mekong River in northeastern Thailand. 64-year-old Ratana Taebwong says the waterway has been her playground, food supply, and income source throughout her life. Now it is changing at a speed she can barely believe.
When I was young, in the dry season, the water would be so low I could walk over to the Laos side. Now the water rises in the dry season, so here I am panning for gold where I still can.
Upstream dams, many built by China, have upended the natural cycles of the river, a waterway that feeds 60 million people as it snakes through Laos, Thailand, Cambodia, Myanmar, and Vietnam. The riverbank used to provide farmland to the poorest Mekong villagers. Now water levels rise and fall without warning when the dams are closed to make electricity and the land yields little. Campaigners say fish species have been decimated, while the downstream is starved of vital sediment, sending a shock through the entire ecosystem. Locals fear a new $2 billion China-backed dam planned for Sanakam on the mainstream of the Mekong in Laos, which is less than 2 kilometers away, will be the end of the living river in northern Thailand. It is currently undergoing a consultation process, but that is widely seen as a formality. From a rare conservation area on the Thai bank, a few kilometers downstream from the proposed dam, local researcher Apisit Suntarawirat has mapped the destruction of the river.
The Chinese and Lao dams have ruined the ecosystem. Many species of fish have vanished due to lack of sediment. 69 types of fish have gone, but it also has an impact on plant species, which are the food source for fish.
Dam operators say they have taken all precautions to mitigate environmental damage, including creating a fish ladder to allow species to migrate during spawning season. But from his river view, though, Apisit says big business in China, Laos, and Thailand is wringing money from a shared natural resource.
Villagers are not getting any benefits from these dams. The only people that gain are the big business people involved.
At this small hut, a network of fishermen defends the river from the big hydropower plants.
I can't describe the strength of the bond I have with the river. The Mekong River is our river of life.
With fish stocks depleted, many fishers have left the waterway for work in rubber fields or factories in the city. For those who eke out a living from the river, another proposed dam in Pak Chum, the first across the Thai stretch of water, would make the people who still eat, live, and work along its waters destitute. Fisher Sutta carries a simple plea to the dam builders.
Please stop. I'm begging you to return the same Mekong River to us. Please don't build any more dams. Enough is enough.
Wichitra Dungdi for VOA News, Nong Khai, Thailand.
And finally, the month of Ramadan begins, and for the second year in a row, Muslims must navigate restrictions during the coronavirus pandemic. AP correspondent Walter Radcliffe has that story.
Last year, the coronavirus upended the routines of Muslims performing the communal rituals associated with Islam's sacred month of Ramadan. The month-long observance, which begins Tuesday across the Middle East, is associated with fasting, worship, and charity. It's when Muslims typically congregate for prayers, gather around festive meals to break their day-long fast, crowd into cafes, and exchange visits. But this year, the world has been hit by an intense new coronavirus wave. The regulations vary in different countries. For many Muslims, that means hopes of a better Ramadan than last year have been dashed with the surge in infection rates. I'm Walter Radcliffe.
And you've been listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of our entire production team, thank you very much for listening. Be sure to stay up to date with world news and events 24 hours a day. You can do so by pointing your web browser on your phone, your tablet, your desktop computer, or any other electronic device to voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Be well, be safe, and have a great day.